very bad.
That's Dandelion,
Ciri repeated in an unfamiliar voice.
Yes, it's him.
It's unfair, thought the Witcher. It's one big bloody injustice. It can't be like this. It shouldn't be like this. I know it was stupid and naive to think that anything ever depended on me, that I somehow influenced the fate of this world, or that this world owes me something. I know it was a naive, arrogant opinion. But I know it. There's no need to convince me about it. It doesn't have to be proved to me. Particularly like this. It's unfair. It can't be Dandelion, he said hollowly, looking down at Roach's mane.
It is Dandelion,
Ciri said again.
Geralt, we have to do something.
What? He asked bitterly. Tell me what. Some soldiers pulled Dandelion from the wagon, treating him, however, with astonishing courtesy, without brutality, with positive reverence, the most they were capable of. They untied his hands before the steps leading to the scaffold. Then he, nonchalantly, scratched his behind and climbed the steps without being urged. One of the steps suddenly creaked, and the railing, made of a rough pole, cracked. Dandelion almost lost his balance.
That needs fixing, damn it! He yelled. You'll see, one day somebody will kill themselves on these steps, and that wouldn't be funny.
Dandelion was intercepted on the scaffolding by two hangman's assistants in sleeveless leather jerkins. The executioner, as broad in the shoulders as a castle keep, looked at the condemned man through slits in his hood. Beside him stood a character in a sumptuous, though funereally black, outfit. He also wore a funereal expression.
"Good gentlemen and burghers of Beauclair and the surroundings," he read thunderously and funereally from an unrolled parchment. "It is known that Julian Alfred Pancratz, Viscount de Lettenhove, alias Dandelion..."
"Pancratz what?" Ciri whispered a question.
"By sentence of the Ducal High Court, has been found guilty of all the crimes, misdeeds, and offences of which he is accused, namely, lese majesté, treason, and furthermore, sullying the dignity of the noble estate through perjury, lampooning, calumny, and slander, also roistering and indecency, as well as debauchery, in other words, harlotry. Thus, the tribunal has adjudged to punish Viscount Julian, etc., primo, by defacing his coat of arms, by painting diagonal black lines on his escutcheon, secundo, by the confiscation of his property, lands, estates, copses, forests, and castles.
Castles, groaned the Witcher. What castles? Dandelion snorted insolently. The expression on his face demonstrated emphatically that he was heartily amused by the confiscation announced by the tribunal.
Tertio, the chief penalty. Anna Henrietta, reigning over us as Her Enlightenment, the Duchess of Toussaint and Lady of Beauclair, has deigned to commute the punishment provided for the above-mentioned crimes of being dragged behind horses, broken on the wheel and quartered, to beheading by axe. May justice be done.
The crowd raised several incoherent shouts. The women standing in the front row began to hypocritically wail and falsely lament. Children were lifted up or carried on shoulders so as not to miss any of the spectacle. The executioner's assistants rolled a stump into the centre of the scaffold and covered it with a napkin. There was something of a commotion, since it turned out someone had swiped the wicker basket for the severed head, but another one was quickly found. Four ragged street urchins had spread out a kerchief beneath the scaffold to catch blood on it. There was great demand for that kind of souvenir. You could earn good money from them.
Geralt!
Ciri didn't raise her lowered head.
We have to do something.
He didn't answer.
I wish to address the townspeople,
Dandelion proudly declared.
Make it short, Viscount.
The poet stood on the edge of the scaffold and raised his hands. The crowd murmured and fell silent.
Hey, people, called Dandelion. What cheer? How go you?
Muddling along,
muttered someone, after a long silence, in a row towards the back.
That's good,
the poet nodded.
I'm greatly content. Well now, we may begin.
Master Executioner, the funereal one said with artificial emphasis, do your duty.
The executioner went closer, kneeled down before the condemned man in keeping with the ancient custom, and lowered his hooded head.
Forgive me, good fellow, he requested gravely.
Me? Asked Dandelion in astonishment. Forgive you? Not a chance. I'll never forgive you. Why should I? Have you heard him, the prankster? He's about to cut my head off, and I'm supposed to forgive him. Are you mocking me or what, at a time like this?
How can you, sir? Asked the executioner, saddened. For there's a law, and a custom. The condemned man must forgive the executioner in advance. Good sir, expunge my guilt, absolve my sin.
No.
No?
No!
I won't behead him,
the executioner declared gloomily, getting up from his knees.
He must forgive me, otherwise there's nothing doing.
Lord Viscount,
the funereal clerk caught Dandelion by the elbow.
Don't make things difficult. People have gathered. They're waiting. Forgive him. He's asking politely, isn't he? I won't forgive him, and that's that.
Master Executioner.
The funereal man approached the executioner.
Chop off his head without being forgiven, eh? I'll see you right.
Without a word, the executioner held out a hand as large as a frying pan. The funereal man sighed, reached into a pouch, and tipped some coins out into his hand. The executioner looked at them for a while, then clenched his fist. The eyes in the slits of his hood flashed malevolently.
Very well,
he said, putting the money away and turning towards the poet.
Kneel down then, Mr. Stubborn. Put your head on the block, Mr. Spiteful.
I can also be spiteful if I want to. I'll take 2 blows to behead you. 3, if I'm lucky.
I absolve you, howled Dandelion. I forgive you.
Thank you.
Since he's forgiven you, said the funereal clerk gloomily, give me back my money.
The executioner turned around and raised the axe.
Step aside, noble sir, he said forebodingly in a dull voice. Don't get in the way of the tool, for where heads are being chopped off, if you get too close, you might lose an ear.
The clerk stepped back suddenly and almost fell off the scaffold.
Like this?
Dandelion kneeled down and stretched his neck on the block.
Master? Hey, master?
What?
You were joking, weren't you? You'll behead me with 1 blow. With 1 swing? Well?
The executioner's eyes flashed.
Let it be a surprise, he snapped portentously.
The crowd suddenly swayed, yielding before a rider bursting into the square on a foaming horse.
Stop!
Yelled the rider, waving a large roll of parchment hung with red seals.
Stop the execution! By ducal order! Out of my way! Stop the execution! I bear a pardon for the condemned man!
Not again,
the executioner snarled, lowering the already raised axe.
Another reprieve! It's starting to get boring.
Mercy! Mercy!
Bellowed the crowd. The matrons in the front row began to lament even louder. A lot of people, mainly youngsters, whistled and moaned in disapproval.
Quieten down, good gentlemen and burghers,
yelled the funereal man, unrolling the parchment.
This is the will of Her Grace Anna Henrietta. In her boundless goodness, in celebration of the peace treaty which, as rumour has it, was signed in the city of Sintra, Her Grace pardons Viscount Julian Alfred Pancratz de Lettenhove, alias Dandelion, and his misdeeds, and waives his execution.
Darling little weasel, said Dandelion, smiling broadly,
ordering at the same time that the above-mentioned Viscount Julian Pancratz, etc., without delay, doth leave the capital and borders of the Duchy of Toussaint and never return, since he offends Her Grace, and Her Grace can no longer countenance him. You are free to go, Viscount.
And my property? Yelled Dandelion.
Eh? You can keep my chattels, copses, forests and castles, but give me back, sod the lot of you, my loot,
my horse Pegasus, 140 tailors and 80 halers, my raccoon-lined cloak, my ring—"
"Shut up!" shouted Geralt,
jostling the fulminating and reluctantly parting crowd with his horse.
"Shut up and get down and come here, you blockhead. Ciri, clear the way. Dandelion, do you hear me?"
"Geralt? Is that you?"
"Don't ask, just get down. Over here, leap onto my horse."
They forced their way through the throng and galloped down the narrow street, Ciri first and Geralt and Dandelion on Roach behind her.
"Why the hurry?" said the bard behind the witch's back. "No one's following us."
"For now. Your duchess likes to change her mind and suddenly cancel what she's already decided. Come clean. Did you know about the pardon?"
"No, no, I didn't," murmured Dandelion. "But I confess, I was counting on it. Little Weasel is a darling and has a very kind heart."
"Enough of that bloody little Weasel, damn it. You've only just wriggled out of Les Majestés. Do you want to fall back into recidivism?"
The troubadour fell silent. Ciri reined back Kelpie and waited for them. When they caught up, she looked at Dandelion and wiped away a tear.
"Oh, you," she said. "You Pancrats."
"Let's go," urged the Witcher. "Let's leave this town and the borders of this enchanting duchy while we still can."
A ducal messenger caught up with them almost at the very border of Toussaint, from where one could already see Gorgon Mountain. He was pulling behind him a saddled Pegasus and was carrying Dandelion's lute, cloak and ring. He ignored the question about the 140 talars and 80 halers. He listened, stony-faced, to the bard's request to give the Duchess a kiss. They rode up the Sans Retour, which was now a tiny, fast-flowing stream. They bypassed Belhaven and camped in the Newey Valley, in a place the Witcher and the bard remembered. Dandelion held out for a very long time. He didn't ask any questions, but he finally had to be told everything, and be accompanied in his silence, in the dreadful, pregnant silence that fell after the telling and festered like a sore. At noon the next day, they were at the slopes outside Riedbrunner. Peace and order reigned all around. The people were sanguine and helpful. It felt safe. Gibbets, heavy with hanging corpses, stood everywhere. They steered clear of the town, heading towards Dorlangre.
"Dandelion."
Geralt had only just noticed what he should have noticed much earlier.
"Your priceless tube. Your centuries of poetry. The messenger didn't have them. They were left in Toussaint."
"They were."
The bard nodded indifferently.
"In little Weasel's wardrobe, under a pile of dresses, knickers and corsets, and may lie there forever."
"Would you like to explain?"
"What's there to explain? I had enough time in Toussaint to read closely what I'd written."
"And?"
"I'm going to write it again, anew."
"I understand."
Geralt nodded. "In short, you turned out to be as poor a writer as you were a favourite. Or, to put it more bluntly, you'll make a fucking mess of whatever you touch."
"Well, but even if you have the chance to improve and rewrite your half a century, you haven't got a fucking prayer with Duchess Anarietta. Ugh, the lover driven away in disgrace. Yes, yes. No point making faces. You weren't meant to be ducal consort in Toussaint, Dandelion. We shall see about that. Don't count on me. I don't mean to be there to see it. And no one's asking you to. I tell you, though, little Weasel has a good and understanding little heart. In truth, she got somewhat carried away when she caught me with young Nike, the Baron's daughter. But now she's sure to have cooled off. Understood that a man isn't created for monogamy. She's forgiven me and is no doubt waiting."
"You're hopelessly stupid," stated Geralt.
And Ciri confirmed she thought the same with an energetic nod of her head.
"I'm not going to discuss it with you," Dandelion sulked, "particularly since it's an intimate matter. I tell you one more time, little Weasel will forgive me. I'll write a suitable ballad or sonnet, send it to her, and she'll..."
"Have mercy, Dandelion."
"Oh, there's really no point talking to you. Let's ride on. Gallop, Pegasus. Gallop, you white-legged flyer."
They rode on. It was May.
"Because of you," the Witcher said reproachfully, "because of you, oh my banished lover,
I also had to flee from Toussaint like some outlaw or exile. I didn't even manage to meet up with Fringilla Vigo. You wouldn't have seen her. She left soon after you set off in January. She simply vanished. I wasn't thinking about her. Geralt cleared his throat, seeing Ciri prick up her ears in interest. I wanted to meet Reinhardt and introduce him to Ciri. Dandelion fixed his gaze on Pegasus's mane.
Reynard de Boisfren, he mumbled, fell in a skirmish with marauders on the Cervantes Pass sometime at the end of February, in the vicinity of the Vedette Watchtower. Anarietta honoured him with a posthumous medal.
Shut up, Dandelion.
Dandelion shut up, admirably obedient. May marched on and matured. The vivid yellow of dandelions disappeared from the meadows, replaced by the downy, grubby, fleeting white of their parachutes. It was green and very warm. The air, if it wasn't freshened by brief storms, was thick, hot, and as sticky as mead. They crossed the Yeruga on the 26th of May, over a very new, very white bridge smelling of resin. The remains of the old bridge, black, scorched, charred timbers, could be seen in the water and on the bank. Ciri became anxious. Geralt knew. He knew her intentions, knew about her plans, about the agreement with Yennefer. He was ready. But in spite of that, the thought of parting stung him painfully, as though a nasty little scorpion had been sleeping in his chest, within him, behind his ribcage, and had now suddenly come awake. A spreading oak tree stood, as it had for at least 100 years, actually, at the crossroads outside the village of Koprozhvenitsa, beyond the ruins of the burnt-down inn. Now, in the spring, it was laden with tiny buds of blossom. People from the whole region, even the remote Spala, were accustomed to using the huge and quite low boughs of the oak to hang up slats and boards bearing all sorts of information. For that reason, the oak tree that served for communication between people was called the Tree of Tidings of Good and Evil.
Ciri, start on that side, ordered Geralt, dismounting. Dandelion, have a look on this side.
The planks on the boughs swayed in the wind, clattering against each other. Searches for missing and separated families usually dominated after a war. There were plenty of declarations of the following kind. Come back, I forgive you. Plenty of offers of erotic massage and similar services in the neighbouring towns and villages, and plenty of announcements and advertisements. There were love letters. There were denunciations signed by well-meaning people, and poison pen letters. There were also boards expressing the philosophical views of their authors, the vast majority of them moronically nonsensical or repulsively obscene.
Ha! Called Dandelion. A witcher is urgently sought in Rustburg Castle. They write that good pay, luxurious accommodation, and extraordinarily tasty board are guaranteed. Will you avail yourself of it, Geralt?
Absolutely not.
Ciri found the information they were looking for, and then announced to the witcher what he had been expecting for a long time.
I'm going to Vengerberg, Geralt, she repeated. Don't make faces like that. You know I have to, don't you? Yennefer summoned me. She's waiting for me there.
I know.
You're going to Rivia, to that rendezvous you're still keeping a secret.
A surprise, he interrupted. It's a surprise, not a secret.
Very well, a surprise. I, meanwhile, will sort out what I need to in Vengerberg, pick up Yennefer, and we'll both be in Rivia in 6 days. Don't make faces, please. And let's not part like it was forever. It's just 6 days. Goodbye.
Goodbye, Ciri.
Rivia, in 6 days,
she repeated once more, reining Kelpie around. She galloped away at once. She was out of sight very quickly, and Geralt felt as though a cold, awful, clawed hand was squeezing his stomach.
6 days, Dandelion repeated pensively. From here to Vengerberg and back to Rivia. Altogether, it'll be close to 250 miles. It's impossible, Geralt. Indeed, on that devilish mare on which the girl can travel at the speed of a courier, 3 times quicker than us, theoretically, very theoretically, she could cover such a distance in 6 days. But even the devilish mare has to rest.
And that mysterious matter that Siri has to take care of will also take some time. And thus, it's impossible.
Nothing is impossible.
The Witcher pursed his lips.
For Siri.
Can it be?
She's not the girl you knew.
Geralt interrupted him harshly.
Not any longer.
Dandelion was silent for a long time.
I have a strange feeling.
Be quiet. Don't say anything, I beg you.
May was over. The new moon was coming. The old moon was waning. It was very thin. They rode towards the mountains, barely visible on the horizon. It was a typical landscape after a war. All of a sudden, graves and burial mounds had sprung up among the fields. Skulls and skeletons lay white amidst the lush spring grass. Corpses hung on roadside trees, and wolves sat beside the roads, waiting for the miserable travellers to weaken. Grass no longer grew on the black patches of land where fires had passed through. The villages and settlements, of which only charred chimneys remained, resounded with the banging of hammers and the rasping of saws. Near the ruins, peasant women dug holes in the scorched earth with hoes. Some of them, stumbling, were pulling harrows and ploughs, and the webbing harnesses bit into their gaunt shoulders. Children hunted for grubs and worms in the newly ploughed furrows.
"I have a vague feeling that something's not as it should be here," said Dandelion. "Something's missing. Do you have that impression, Geralt?"
"Eh?"
"Something's not normal here."
"Nothing's normal here, Dandelion. Nothing."
During the warm, black and windless night, lit up by distant flashes of lightning and restless growls of thunder, Geralt and Dandelion saw from their camp the horizon in the west blooming with the red glow of fire. It wasn't far, and the wind that blew up brought the smell of smoke. The wind also brought snatches of sound. They heard, like it or not, the howling of people being murdered, the wailing of women, and the brash and triumphant yelling of bandits. Dandelion said nothing, glancing fearfully at the Witcher every now and then. But the Witcher didn't even twitch, didn't even turn his head around, and his face seemed to be cast in bronze. They continued on their journey the next morning. They didn't even look at the thin trail of smoke rising above some trees. And later, they chanced upon a column of settlers. They were walking in a long line, slowly, carrying small bundles. They walked in complete silence. Men, boys, women and children. They walked without grumbling, without tears, without a word of complaint. Without screams, without any desperate wailing. But there were screams and despair in their eyes, in the empty eyes of people who had been damaged, robbed, beaten, driven away.
"Who are they?"
Dandelion ignored the hostility visible in the eyes of the officer supervising the march.
"Who are you driving like this?"
"The Nilfgaardians,"
snapped a sub-lieutenant from the height of his saddle. He was a ruddy-faced stripling of no more than 18 summers.
"Nilfgaardian settlers. They appeared in our lands like cockroaches, and we'll sweep them away like cockroaches. So it was decided in Sintra, and so it was written in the peace treaty."
He leaned over and spat.
"And if it was up to me,"
he continued, looking defiantly at Dandelion and the Witcher,
"I wouldn't let them get out of here alive, the rats."
"And if it depended on me,"
said a non-commissioned officer with a grey moustache, in a slow, drawling voice, looking at his commander with a gaze strangely devoid of respect,
"I'd leave them in peace on their farms. I wouldn't drive good farmers from the land. I'd be glad that agriculture was prospering, that there's something to eat."
"You're as thick as pig shit, Sergeant,"
snapped the sub-lieutenant.
"It's Nilfgaard. It's not our language, not our culture, not our blood. We'd be glad of the agriculture, and nursing a viper in our bosom. Traitors, ready to stab us in the back. Perhaps you think there'll be harmony with the Black Cloaks forever. No, they can go back where they came from. Hey, soldiers, that one has a cart. Get it off him, at the double."
The order was carried out extremely zealously, with the use not only of heels and fists, but truncheons too. Dandelion gave a slight cough.
What? Something not to your liking, perhaps?
The youthful sub-lieutenant glared at him.
Perhaps you're a Nilfgaard lover.
Heaven forbid. Dandelion swallowed. Many of the empty-eyed women and girls, walking like automatons, had torn garments, swollen and bruised faces, and thighs and calves marked by trickles of dried blood. Many of them had to be supported as they walked. Dandelion looked at Geralt's face and began to be afraid.
"Time we were going," he mumbled. "Farewell, gentlemen."
The sub-lieutenant didn't even turn his head around, preoccupied with checking that none of the settlers were carrying luggage larger than the piece of Sintra had determined. The column of settlers walked on. They heard the high-pitched, desperate screams of a woman in great pain.
"Geralt, no," groaned Dandelion. "Don't do anything. I beg you, don't get involved."
The Witcher turned his face towards him, and Dandelion didn't recognize it.
"Get involved," he repeated. "Intervene. Rescue somebody. Risk my neck for some noble principles or ideas." "Oh no, Dandelion. Not any longer."
One night, a restless night, lit up by distant flashes of lightning, a dream woke the Witcher again. He wasn't certain this time, either, if he hadn't gone straight from one nightmare to another. Once again, a pulsating brightness that frightened the horses rose above the remains of the campfire. Once again, there was a great castle, black colonnades, and a table with women sitting around it in the brightness. Two of the women weren't sitting but standing, one in black and white, and the other in black and grey. It was Yennefer and Ciri. The Witcher groaned in his sleep. Yennefer was right to quite categorically advise Ciri against wearing male clothing. Dressed like a boy, Ciri would have felt foolish here, now, in the hall among these elegant women sparkling with jewellery. She was pleased she'd agreed to dress in a combination of black and grey. It flattered her when she felt approving looks on her puffed, paned sleeves and high waist, on the velvet ribbon bearing the small, rose-shaped diamond brooch.
"Please, come closer."
Ciri shuddered a little, not just at the sound of that voice. Yennefer, it turned out, had been right in one more thing. She had advised against a plunging neckline. Ciri, however, had insisted, and now had the impression the draft was literally raging over her chest, and her whole front, almost to her navel, was covered in gooseflesh.
"Come closer,"
repeated the dark-haired, dark-eyed woman, whom Ciri knew and remembered from the Isle of Thaneth. And although Yennefer had told her whom she would meet in Monte Calvo, had described them all and taught her all of their names, Ciri at once began to entitle her Madam Owl in her thoughts.
"Welcome to the Monte Calvo Lodge," said Madam Owl, "Miss Ciri."
Ciri bowed as Yennefer had instructed, politely, but more in the male fashion, without a ladylike curtsy, without a modest and submissive lowering of her eyes. She responded with a smile to Triss Merigold's sincere and pleasant smile, and with a somewhat lower nod of the head to Margarita Lozantila's friendly look. She endured the remaining eight pairs of eyes, although they pierced like gimlets, stabbed like spear blades.
"Please be seated,"
beckoned Madam Owl with a truly regal gesture.
"No, not you, Yennefer. Just her. You, Yennefer, are not an invited guest, but a felon, summoned to be judged and punished. You will stand until the lodge decides on your fate."
Protocol was over for Ciri in a flash.
"In that case, I shall also stand," she said, not at all quietly. "I'm no guest either. I was also summoned to be informed about my fate. That's the first thing. And the second is that Yennefer's fate is my fate. What applies to her applies to me. We cannot be rent asunder, with all due respect."
Margarita Lozantila smiled, looking her in the eyes. The modest, elegant woman with a slightly aquiline nose, who could only be the Nilfgaardian Azirava Anahid, nodded and tapped her fingers lightly on the table.
"Philippa," said a woman with her neck wrapped in a silver fox fur boa, "we don't have time to be so uncompromising, it seems to me.
At least not today. Not right now. This is the lodge's round table. We sit at it as equals, even if we are to be judged. I think we can all agree about what we should.
She didn't finish, but swept her eyes over the remaining sorceresses. They, meanwhile, expressed their agreement by nodding. Margarita, Azira, Triss, Sabrina Glevisig, Kira Metz, and the two beautiful elf women. Only the other Nilfgaardian, the raven-haired Fringilla Vigo, sat motionless, very pale, not resting her eyes from Yennefer.
Let it be so.
Philippa Eilhart waved a ringed hand.
Sit down, both of you, despite my opposition. But the lodge's unity comes before everything. The lodge's interests before everything, and above everything. The lodge is everything, the rest nothing. I hope you understand, Ciri.
Very well.
Ciri had no intention of lowering her gaze,
particularly since I am that nothing.
Francesca Finderbeer, the stunning elf woman, gave a peal of resonant laughter.
Congratulations, Yennefer, she said in her hypnotically melodic voice. I recognize an outstanding hallmark, the purity of the gold. I recognize the school.
It isn't difficult to recognize.
Yennefer swept a passionate look around her.
For it's the school of Tessiah de Vries. Tessiah de Vries is dead, Madame Owl said calmly. She's not present at this table. Tessiah de Vries died, and the matter has been grieved and mourned. It was simultaneously a landmark and a turning point. For a new time has dawned, a new era has come, and great changes are coming. And fate has assigned you an important role in these transformations, Ciri. You, who once were Cirilla of Sintra, you probably already know what role.
I know,
she snapped, not reacting to Yennefer's restraining hiss.
Velgefortz explained it to me, while preparing to stick a glass syringe between my legs. If that's supposed to be my destiny, then I, respectfully, decline.
Philippa's dark eyes flashed with a cold anger, but it was Sheila de Tankerville who spoke.
You still have much to learn, child, she said,
wrapping the silver fox fur boa around her neck.
You will have to unlearn many things I see and hear, by your own efforts or with someone's help. You have lately come into possession, it can be gathered, of much evil knowledge. You have also certainly endured evil, experienced evil. Now, in your childish rage, you refuse to notice the good. You deny the good and good intentions. You bristle like a hedgehog, unable to recognize precisely those who are concerned with your good. You snort and bare your claws like a wild kitten without leaving us a choice. You need to be grabbed by the scruff of the neck. And we shall do that, child, without a second thought. For we are older than you. We are wiser. We know everything about what has been and what is, and we know much about what will be. We shall take you by the scruff of the neck, Kitty, so you may one day soon sit here among us at this table as an experienced and wise she-cat, as one of us.
No, not a word. Don't you dare open your mouth when Sheila de Tankerville is speaking.
The voice of the Kaviran sorceress, sharp and piercing like a knife scraping against iron, suddenly hung in mid-air over the table. Not only Ciri cowered. The other witches of the lodge shuddered slightly and drew their heads into their shoulders. Well, perhaps with the exception of Philippa, Francesca and Azira, and Yennefer.
You were right, continued Sheila, wrapping the boa around her neck, in thinking that you were summoned to Monte Calvo to be informed about your fate. You weren't right to think you are nothing. For you are everything. You are the future of the world. At this moment, naturally, you don't know that, can't know that. At this moment, you're a puffed-up and spitting kitten, a traumatized child, who sees in everybody Emir Vae Emrys or Vilgefortz holding his inseminator. And there's no point now, at this moment, explaining to you that you are mistaken, that it concerns your good and the good of the world. The time will come for such explanations, one day. Now, hot under the collar, you don't want to listen to the voice of reason. Now, for every argument, you will have a riposte in the form of childish stubbornness and noisy indignation. Now, you will simply be grabbed by the scruff of the neck. I have finished. Inform the girl of her fate, Philippa.
Ciri sat stiff, stroking the heads of the sphinxes carved into the armrests of the chair.
You will go to Covia with Shayla and I.
Madam Owl broke the heavy and dead silence. To Poinvanis, the royal summer capital.
Because you are no longer Cirilla of Sintra, you will be presented at the audience as a novice in magic, our pupil. At the audience, you will meet a very wise king, Esterad Tyson, of genuine royal blood. You will meet his wife, Queen Zuleika, a person of extraordinary nobility and goodness. You will also meet the royal couple's son, Prince Tancred.
Ciri, beginning to understand, opened her eyes widely. Madam Owl noticed it.
Yes, she confirmed. You must make an impression on Prince Tancred above all, for you will become his lover and bear his child. Were you still Cirilla of Sintra?
Philippa took the conversation up after a long pause.
Were you still the daughter of Pavetta and the granddaughter of Calanthe, we would make you Tancred's wedded wife, princess, and later queen of Covia and Povis. Sadly, and I say this with real sorrow, fate has deprived you of everything, including the future. You will only be a lover, a favourite.
By name, and formally, interjected Shayla, for in practice we shall try hard for you to gain the status of princess by Tancred's side, and afterwards even of queen. Your help will be necessary, naturally. Tancred must desire you to be at his side, day and night. We'll teach you how to fuel such a desire, but whether the lesson is learned will depend on you.
Those titles are essentially trifles, said Madam Owl. It's important that Tancred impregnates you as quickly as possible.
Well, that's obvious, Ciri muttered.
The lodge will provide for the future and position of your child.
Philippa didn't take her eyes off Ciri.
You deserve to know we're thinking here about matters of great note. You will be participating in it in any case, since right after the birth of the child, you will begin to take part in our gatherings. You will learn, since you are, although it may be incomprehensible to you today, one of us.
You called me a monster on the Isle of Thaneth, Madam Owl.
Ciri overcame the constriction in her throat.
And today, you tell me I'm one of you.
There's no contradiction in that,
resounded the voice of Enid Angliana, the Daisy of the Valleys, as melodic as the burbling of a stream.
We, Melunet, are all monsters, each in our own way. Isn't that right, Madame Owl?
Philippa shrugged.
We shall disguise that hideous scar on your face with an illusion.
Shayla spoke again, tugging at her boa, apparently indifferently.
You will be beautiful and mysterious, and Tancred Tyson, I assure you, will lose his head for you. We'll have to invent some personal details for you. Cirilla is a nice name and is by no means so rare that you would have to give it up to remain incognito. But we have to give you a surname. I wouldn't protest if you chose mine.
Or mine, said Madame Owl, smiling with the corners of her mouth. Cirilla Eilhart also sounds nice. That name,
the silver bells of the Daisy of the Valleys jingled in the hall again,
sounds nice in every combination, and each of us sitting here would like to have a daughter like you, Zirael, or Swallow with the eyes of a falcon, you who bear the blood and bones of Lara Dorin's blood and bones. Each of us would give up everything, even the lodge, even the fate of the kingdoms and the whole world, to have a daughter like you. But it's impossible. We know that it's impossible, which is why we envy Yennefer.
Thank you, Madame Philippa,
Ciri said a moment later, clenching her hands on the Sphinx's heads.
I'm also honoured at the offer of bearing the name Tankerville. However, because a surname is the only thing in this whole matter that depends on me and my choice, the only thing that isn't being imposed on me, I have to gratefully decline and choose for myself. I want to be called Ciri of Vengerberg. Daughter of Yennefer.
Ha!
A black-haired sorceress, whom Ciri guessed was Sabrina Glevisig of Caedwin, flashed her teeth.
Tancred Tyson will prove to be an ass if he doesn't wed her morganatically. If instead of her, he lets some drippy princess be foisted upon him. He'll turn out to be an ass and a blind man, unable to recognize a diamond among pieces of glass. Congratulations, Yenna. I envy you, and you know how sincerely I can envy.
Yennefer thanked her with a nod of her head, without even the ghost of a smile.
And thus, said Philippa, everything is settled.
No, said Ciri.
Francesca Finderbeer snorted softly. Sheila de Tankerville raised her head, and her facial features hardened unpleasantly.
I have to think the matter over, Ciri declared. Ponder it. Sort everything out in my mind, calmly. Once I've done that, I'll return here to Monte Calvo. I'll appear before you, ladies. I'll tell you what I've decided.
Sheila moved her lips, as though she'd found something in her mouth she ought to spit out at once, but she didn't speak.
I have arranged to meet the witcher Geralt in the city of Rivia.
Ciri lifted her head up.
I promised him I'd meet him there, that I'd ride there with Yennefer. I'll keep that promise, with your permission, or without it. Madame Reiter, who is here, knows that I always find a crack in the wall if I'm going to Geralt.
Margarita Lozantila nodded with a smile.
I must talk to Geralt, say goodbye to him, and admit he's right. Because you ought to know one thing, ladies. When we were riding away from Stigger Castle, leaving corpses in our wake, I asked Geralt if it was the end, if we were victorious, if evil had been overcome, and if good had triumphed. And he just smiled, somehow strangely and sadly. I thought it was from tiredness, because we had buried all of his friends at the foot of Stigger. But now I know what that smile meant. It was a smile of pity, at the naivety of a child who thought that the slit throats of Vilgefortz and Bonhart meant the triumph of good over evil. I really must tell him I've grown wiser, that I've understood. I really must tell him. I must also try to convince him that what you want to do with me fundamentally differs from what Vilgefortz wanted to do to me with a glass syringe. I have to explain to him that there is a difference between Monte Calvo Castle and Stigger Castle, even though Vilgefortz was concerned with the good of the world, and you are also concerned with the good of the world. I know it won't be easy to convince an old wolf like Geralt. Geralt will say I'm a chit, that it's easy to beguile me with appearances of nobility, that all this bloody destiny and good of the world are stupid platitudes. But I must try. It's important that he understands and accepts it. It's very important. For you too, ladies.
You haven't understood anything, said Sheila de Tankerville harshly. You're still a child, passing from the stage of callow howling and foot-stamping to callow arrogance. The only thing that raises hope is your sharpness of mind. You'll learn quickly. Soon, believe me, you'll laugh, recalling the nonsense you talked here. As regards your trip to Rivia, I pray you let the Lodge express its opinion. I'm expressing my firm opposition, for fundamental reasons. To prove to you that I, Sheila de Tankerville, never waste words, and am capable of making you bend your proud neck. You need to be taught discipline for your own good.
Let's settle this matter, then.
Philippa Eilhard placed her palms on the table.
Ladies, please express your opinions. Are we to permit the haughty maid Ciri to ride to Rivia for a meeting with some witcher for whom there soon won't be a place in her life? Are we to let sentimentalism grow in her, sentimentality that she will soon have to utterly get rid of? Sheila is opposed, and the rest of you ladies?
I'm against, declared Sabrina Glevesig. Also for fundamental reasons. I like the girl. I like what she says, her insolence and hot-tempered impudence. I prefer it to spineless acquiescence. I wouldn't have anything against her request, particularly since she would certainly return. People such as she don't break their word. But the little madam has threatened us. She must know we disregard such threats.
I'm opposed, said Kira Metz, for practical reasons. I like the girl too, and Geralt carried me in his arms on Thanith. There isn't a scrap of sentimentality in me, but it was awfully pleasant. It would be a way of repaying him. But no. For you are mistaken, Sabrina. The girl is a witcher and is trying to outwit us. In short, make a run for it. Does anyone here?
Yennefer drawled malevolently. "Dare to doubt the words of my daughter?"
"You, Yennefer, be quiet," hissed Philippa. "Don't speak or I lose my patience. There are 3 votes against. Let's hear the rest."
"I vote to allow her to go," said Triss Merigold. "I know her and vouch for her. I'd also like to accompany her on her journey, if she agrees. Help her in her deliberations and reflections, if she agrees. And in her conversation with Geralt, if she agrees."
"I'm also in favour," smiled Margarita Lozantila. "What I will say will astonish you, ladies, but I'm doing it for Tessire de Vries. Were Tessire here, she would be outraged at the suggestion that compulsion and the restriction of personal freedom are necessary to maintain the unity of the Lodge."
"I vote in favour," said Francesca Findebear, straightening the lace on her neckline. "There are many reasons, but I don't have to reveal them, nor do I intend to."
"I vote in favour," said Ida Emain Epsivni, just as laconically, "because my heart compels me thus."
"And I'm opposed," declared Azirva Anahid dryly. "I'm not driven by any sympathy, antipathy, or fundamental issues. I fear for Ciri's life. She is safe in the Lodge's care, but an easy target on the roads leading to Rivia. And I worry that there are people who, even having taken away her name and identity, will still think that's not enough."
"It remains for us to learn the position of Madame Fringilla Vigo," said Sabrina Glevisig quite scathingly. "Although it should be obvious, for I take the liberty of reminding you all of Rhys Run Castle." "Although I am grateful for the reminder," Fringilla Vigo lifted her head proudly, "I vote for Ciri, to show the respect and affection I have for the girl. And more than anything, I'm doing it for Geralt of Rivia, the Witcher, without whom that girl wouldn't be here today, who, in order to rescue Ciri, went to the end of the world, fighting everything that stood in his way, even himself. It would be wickedness to deny him a meeting with her."
"Yet there was too little wickedness," Sabrina said cynically, "and too much naive sentimentality, the same sentimentality we mean to eradicate from this maiden.
Why, there was even talk about hearts, and the result is that the scales are in the balance, in deadlock. We haven't decided anything. We'll have to vote again, I suggest, by secret ballot."
"What for?"
They all looked at the person who had spoken. Yennefer.
"I am still a member of this lodge," said Yennefer. "No one has taken my membership away from me. No one has taken my place. I have the formal right to vote. I think it's clear who I'm voting for. The votes in favour prevail, so the matter is settled."
"Your insolence,"
said Sabrina, locking her fingers armed with onyx rings, "borders on bad taste, Yennefer."
"In your place, madam, I would sit in humble silence," added Shaela grimly, "bearing in mind the voting of which you soon will be the subject."
"I backed Ciri," said Francesca, "but I must take you to task, Yennefer. You left the lodge, fleeing from it and refusing to cooperate. You don't have any rights. You do, though, have obligations, debts to pay, a sentence to hear. Were it not for that, you wouldn't have been allowed to cross Monte Calvo's threshold."
Yennefer restrained Ciri, who was itching to stand up and shout. Without resisting, and in silence, Ciri sank into the chair with the armrests carved into sphinxes, watching Madame Owl, Philippa Eilhart, getting up from her chair and suddenly towering over the table.
"Yennefer doesn't have the right to vote, that is clear," she announced in a ringing tone. "But I do. I've listened to the votes of all the women present here, so I can finally vote myself, I believe."
"What do you mean by that, Philippa?"
Sabrina frowned. Philippa Eilhart looked across the table. She met Ciri's eyes and looked into them. The bottom of the pool is made of a many-coloured mosaic, the tiles shimmering and seeming to move. The entire surface trembles, glimmering with light and shade. Carp and orf flash by under lily leaves as large as plates amidst green pondweed. The young girl's large dark eyes reflect in the water. Her long hair reaches down to the surface, floating on it. The girl, forgetting about the whole world, runs her little hands among the stems of water lilies and hangs over the edge of the pool surrounding the fountain. She would love to touch one of the small golden red fishes. The fish swim up to the girl's hands. They circle around her curiously, but they don't let themselves be seized. They're as elusive as apparitions, like the water itself. The dark-eyed girl's fingers close on nothingness.
Philippa!
It's her most favourite voice. In spite of that, the little girl doesn't react right away. She continues to look at the water, at the little fish, at the water lilies, and at her own reflection.
Philippa!
Philippa!
Sherla de Tankerville's harsh voice shook her out of her reverie.
We're waiting.
A cold spring wind blew in through the open window. Philippa Eilhart shuddered.
Death, she thought. Death passed beside me.
This lodge,
she finally said confidently, loudly and emphatically,
will decide the fates of the world, because this lodge is like the world, is its mirror. Good sense, which doesn't always mean cold wickedness and calculation, is balancing out sentimentality, which is not always naive. Responsibility, iron discipline, even if imposed by force, and aversion to violence. Gentleness and trust. The matter-of-fact coolness of omnipotence and heart. I, casting my vote last, take one more thing into consideration, she continued into the silence that had descended on the colonnaded hall in Monte Calvo. One that, though it doesn't balance out anything, counterbalances everything. Following her gaze, all the women looked at the wall, at the mosaic constructed from tiny coloured tiles depicting the snake Ouroboros grasping its tail in its teeth. That thing is destiny, she continued, fixing her dark eyes on Ciri, which I, Philippa Eilhart, have only recently begun to believe in. Which I, Philippa Eilhart, have only recently begun to understand. Destiny isn't the judgments of providence, isn't scrolls written by the hand of a demiurge, isn't fatalism. Destiny is hope. Being full of hope, believing that what is meant to happen will happen, I cast my vote. I vote for Ciri, the child of destiny, the child of hope.
The silence in the colonnaded hall of Monte Calvo Castle, plunged in subtle chiaroscuro, lasted a long time. The cry of an osprey circling over the lake reached them from outside the window.
Madame Yennefer, Ciri whispered. Does that mean...
Let's go, daughter,
answered Yennefer in a soft voice.
Geralt's waiting for us, and there's a long road ahead.
Geralt awoke and leapt to his feet with a cry of a nightbird in his ears. Then the sorceress and the witcher were married and held a grand wedding party. I too was there. I drank mead and wine. And then they lived happily ever after, but for a very short time. He died, ordinarily, of a heart attack. She died soon after him, but of what the tale does not say. They say of sorrow and longing, but who would lend credence to fairy tales? Florence Delanoy, Fairy Tales and Stories. Chapter 12. It was the sixth day after the June new moon when they arrived in Rivia. They rode out of the forests onto the hillsides, and then, beneath them, down below, suddenly and without warning, twinkled and glittered the surface of Loch Escalot, which filled the valley in the shape of the rune from which it took its name. The hillsides of Craig Ross, the protruding end of the Mahakam Massif, covered in fir and larch, gazed at their own reflections in the lake's surface, as did the red tiles of the towers of the stout Rivia Castle, the winter seat of the kings of Lyria, standing on a headland extending into the lake. And by a bay at the southern end of Loch Escalot lay the town of Rivia, with the bright thatch of the cottages around the castle and dark houses growing by the lakeshore like mushrooms.
"Well, we seem to have arrived," Dandelion stated, shielding his eyes with his hand. "Now we've come full circle. We're in Rivia."
"Strange, how strange are the twists of fate. I don't see blue and white pennants on any of the castle towers, and thus Queen Maeve is not residing at the castle. I don't suppose in any case that she still remembers our desertion."
"Believe me, Dandelion," Geralt interrupted, steering his horse down the hillside. "I don't give a damn who remembers what."
A colourful tent, resembling a cake, stood outside the city, not far from the turnpike. A white shield with a red chevron hung on a pole in front of it. A knight in full armour and a white surcoat, decorated with the same arms as the shield, was standing under the raised flap of the tent. The knight was scrutinising women in headscarves, tar and pitchmakers with kegs containing their wares, herdsmen, peddlers and beggars. His eyes lit up in hope at the sight of Geralt and Dandelion riding slowly along.
"The lady of your heart,"
Geralt dispelled the knight's hope in an icy voice.
"Whoever she is the most beautiful and most virtuous virgin from the Yeruga to the Boena." "By my troth," the knight snapped back. "You speak the truth, sir."
A fair-haired girl in a densely studded leather jacket vomited in the middle of the street, bent in two, holding onto the stirrup of a flea-bitten grey mare. The girl's two male companions, identically attired, carrying swords on their backs and wearing bands on their foreheads, cursed the passers-by filthily in somewhat incoherent voices. Both were more than tipsy, unsteady on their feet, bumping into horses' sides and the bar of the hitching post situated outside the inn.
"Must we really go in there?" asked Dandelion. "There may be more nice lads like that inside."
"I'm meeting someone here. Have you forgotten? This is the rooster and mother hen mentioned in a notice on the oak tree."
The fair-haired girl bent over again, puked spasmodically and extremely profusely. The mare snorted loudly and jerked, knocking the girl over and dragging her through the vomit.
"What are you gawking at, you fool?" mumbled one of the youngsters. "You grey-haired old bum."
"Geralt," muttered Dandelion, dismounting. "Don't do anything foolish, please."
"Fear not. I won't."
They tied their horses to the hitching post on the other side of the steps. The young men stopped paying attention to them and began insulting and spitting at a townswoman crossing the street with a child. Dandelion glanced at the witch's face. He didn't like what he saw. The first thing that stuck out after entering the inn was a sign. Wanted. Cook. The next was a large picture on a signboard made of planks of wood, portraying a bearded monster holding a battle axe dripping blood. The caption announced, "The dwarf, a wretched, treacherous runt." Dandelion was right to be worried. In practice, the only guests in the inn, apart from a few seriously drunk drunks and two skinny prostitutes with dark circles around their eyes, were more lads dressed up in leather, sparkling with studs, with swords on their backs. There were 8 of them, of both sexes, but they were making enough of a commotion for 18, shouting over each other and swearing.
"I recognise you and know who you are, gentlemen."
The innkeeper surprised them as soon as he saw them.
"And I have news for you. You're to go to a tavern called Versing's in Elm."
"Ooh," Dandelion cheered up. "That's good. I wouldn't know about that."
The innkeeper went back to drying a mug on his apron.
"If you disdain my establishment, that's your choice. But I'll tell you that Elm's a dwarven district where non-humans reside."
"And what of it?"
Geralt squinted his eyes.
"Aye, I'm sure it doesn't bother you."
The innkeeper shrugged.
"Why, the one who left the news was a dwarf. Since you associate with such as he, that's your affair. It's your affair whose company you find more agreeable."
"We aren't particularly fussy as regards company," announced Dandelion,
nodding towards the youths in black jackets, with bands around their pimply foreheads, yelling and wrestling at a table.
"But I swear we aren't fond of that kind."
The innkeeper put down the dry mug and glared at them unpleasantly.
"You should be more understanding," he instructed with emphasis. "Youngsters have to let off steam. There's a certain saying, youngsters have to let off steam. The war damaged them. Their fathers perished. And their mothers screwed around," finished Geralt,
with a voice as icy as a mountain lake. I understand, and I'm full of understanding. At least I'm trying hard to be. Let's go, Dandelion.
Be off with you.